What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Do you want me around or not? Do you even like me?
Of course I like you, Adam.
How much?
What?
I need to know how much you like me.
I don't know what that means. How much? How can I rate a person in that way?
Sam Rockwell's Chuck Barris may not have known how he felt about long-suffering girlfriend Penny, but listeners know exactly how they feel about Rockwell. Results from our listener poll about their favorite Rockwell performance.
There have been a few good ones.
Plus my quick chat with the actor coming up on the show.
We've also got a review roundup that should help you plan your next couple of movie nights. Our takes on several titles just released on DVD. That's ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 20% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM9.
And by audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has now more than 150,000 titles to choose from in every genre. And we're going to give you a few recommendations here that come from listeners and also just a little bit of my browsing on Audible, keeping with our Stanley Kubrick theme here last week and on this week's show as well. Jennifer Calder, a listener, posted on our Facebook page and said, it's probably been suggested before, but my pick is Lolita, narrated by Jeremy Irons. Best audiobook ever. I do love the Vladimir Nabokov book. I love Jeremy Irons as an actor, even though I didn't completely love that adaptation. But you put Nabokov and Irons together, it is hard to argue with Jennifer's recommendation. There's more on Audible if you're on a Stanley Kubrick kick, as we are. They've got 2001 A Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke, the unabridged version of that. They also have I Am Spartacus, Making a Film, Breaking the Blacklist by Kirk Douglas, narrated by his son, Michael.
You can always send your own Audible recommendations to us at feedback@filmspotting.net or post them on the Film Spotting Facebook page, facebook.com/filmspotting. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
You're listening to Film Spotting. If you tuned into last week's show, you know that due to a head cold and the loss of my voice, literally just hours before we taped Film Spotting, I was not able to take part in the show's journey to the infinite and beyond. Josh was, though, ably assisted by the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips for our Sacred Cow review of 2001, A Space Odyssey. We will have to ponder forever, Josh, just like the last 20 minutes of 2001, whether my body was just responding to a week's worth of anxiety about the prospect of trying to probe the mysteries of Kubrick's masterpiece. We'll never probably get the answer. I'll allow, though, that it's a distinct possibility. But I am back, and later in the show, I'll finally get a chance to share some of my thoughts on 2001.
But first, something slightly less heady. Actor Sam Rockwell. His new film, A Single Shot, opens in limited release this weekend and is currently available via cable on demand. Adam had a chance to talk with Rockwell recently about the film and about his career as a serial scene stealer. We'll hear that conversation in just a bit. First, let's share the results of last week's Rockwellian poll question.
We did think this would maybe be a nice way to set up my conversation with Mr. Rockwell. We were curious, anticipating this interview, what your favorite Sam Rockwell performance was. We gave you these options. Chuck Barris in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, Guy Fleegman, very funny turn in Galaxy Quest, Frank Mercer, his role opposite Nick Cage in Matchstick Men, or you could go with his lead turn as Sam Bell in the Duncan Jones film Moon, a big Film Spotting favorite and the inaugural Golden Brick winner here on the show. You could also choose one of his recent performances, Billy, in Martin McDonagh's Seven Psychopaths. Or if you don't like any of those candidates we gave you, you could choose other and write in your vote. Josh, how did it come out?
Only 5% voted for Matchstick Men's Frank Mercer, so that's last place there. 10% went to Seven Psychopaths' Billy, with another 10% tie here went to Galaxy Quest's Guy Fleegman. Pulling a little bit ahead with 12% was the option of other. Some people did go that direction. And 13% voted for Confessions of a Dangerous Mind's Chuck Barris. But running away with it, no surprise, given the love listeners have for Moon is Sam Bell, 50% of the vote.
Half of the votes there going for Sam Bell in Moon. I knew it would win, Josh. I didn't think it would run away with it quite that much, though. I did almost leave it out of the options just because I thought it would make it a little bit more interesting. And you saw a lot of parody there in the results. I believe, if I heard correctly last week on the show, Michael went with Other. He actually voted for his character in Snow Angels,
the
David Gordon Green movie.
Surprising pick.
You did go with Chuck Barris. I love that movie.
I do, just because I love the movie that much more than Moon, which I like Moon too. Calm down, everyone.
Yeah, I think I would have gone with the majority there and probably voted for Sam Bell in Moon, mainly because, and you see it there in the choices, he plays a lot of supporting turns. And that was a role that required him to own that movie, other than having that supporting character there in the robot or the Kevin Spacey voiced character there. Gertie, I believe, was the name, sort of the version in Moon of Hal in 2001. He's pretty much all by himself, and I thought he carried that role, so I'd go there. But I really like him a lot in not only all those roles, Josh, but Frank Mercer in Matchstick Men is another one there where, because of the way Rockwell plays him, and I think even because of what we bring to a Sam Rockwell performance, there's an expectation of the type of character he is that ends up paying off at the end of the film in a really interesting way. I think there's a little bit of a twist there in that Ridley Scott film. With that, let's get to some of the comments we got to this poll question, starting with Chris in Indianapolis.
This was a tough call. For pure enjoyability, I never miss an opportunity to watch Sam Rockwell ham it up as Guy Fliegman, the insecure actor in Galaxy Quest. But if I were to select a performance of his to recommend to someone unfamiliar with his work, Moon would be my first choice. With the range of emotions Sam Bell experiences in that movie, it's an actor's dream role, and Rockwell more than delivers. It's the one performance that can convince the uninitiated that he deserves to be ranked among the best actors working today.
Theo from Boise, I believe we heard from him last week. I like that we're getting some returnees here, Josh. A lot of familiar names in our poll comments. I'd like to get a few new names as well, though. Theo says, it was very close for me. Moon is a masterpiece of suspense, but Rockwell's brilliant turn in Seven Psychopaths, a movie I don't think gets enough love, was a masterclass in how to be crazy, violent, yet somehow sympathetic.
Andy H. here has a vote for the other category and brings up a movie I'm not familiar with, Lawn Dogs. He says it's a well-written, brilliantly acted, and criminally underrated film. All of the trademark Rockwell traits are here, the raffish charm, the wry smile, the lovable loser, the quirky humor, and the genuine warmth that makes him likable in all of the options you gave us. Lawn Dogs is a coming-of-age film that also takes in American class divide, childhood fables, magical realism, and the hypocrisy of gated communities and patriotism. It's that rare thing of being a film featuring Sam Rockwell in which he doesn't overshadow everything else in it.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
It's one that is also completely off my radar, or has been, and I'd like to catch up with it. Matt from Portland, Oregon writes, even though I voted for Rockwell's performance in Moon as my favorite, I really started liking him so much more after going back and watching one of my favorite childhood movies, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and realizing that he was one of the leaders of Shredder's child clan.
I love that when you see one of your favorite actors pop up in something long ago.
Well, Seven Psychopaths is going to come up in my conversation with him. Lawn Dogs did not, and neither did Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
No, he doesn't talk about that much, huh?
You know what? I didn't bring it up. Maybe I should have. We have one more comment here, and really this is the one we have to close with.
Jack from Arlington, Virginia says, oh, get a room already. How many more years do we have to listen to Film Spotting apologize for Rockwell's good roles in mediocre films without ever acknowledging his utter self-consciousness as an actor? There's a level of desperation to everything he does, because Rockwell imagines that if he can shove enough grins and ticks into a performance, he'll have something that resembles a character at the end. Rockwell finally found something of a sweet spot in The Way, Way Back, another entry into his catalog of mediocre cinema, by playing the role he was born to play, Sam effin' Rockwell. The fact that this poor man's Kevin Bacon continues to enrapture Adam simply mystifies me. I admire Rockwell for grinding it out in the business despite such limited range, but that doesn't mean I have to respect him. Okay, I'm done. Great show. I'll send you money and stuff.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate that you'll still send us some money and stuff, but you really are all alone on this one. And Rockwell's latest, A Single Shot, I think might be the best rebuttal to Jack's grins and ticks criticism there, his take on Rockwell. He plays in this movie John Moon. Yes, his name is John Moon, a man estranged from his wife and son. He's living alone in this backwoods area of a small town, and he takes a shot at a deer while out hunting and ends up killing a young woman who appears to be hiding out. He finds a bag full of money in her makeshift camp, and of course he takes it. And of course, he gets in way over his head as bad guys swirl in search of their loot. You know all this because you've probably seen A Simple Plan and No Country for Old Men and a handful of other similar films. When I spoke to Rockwell via phone a few weeks ago, I asked him if that familiarity was something he too had to look past, or was there something that he felt was truly unique about this character and this story?
Well, I think it was David's vision on how to tell it that would be unique. You know, having that kind of film noir structure, but then setting it in a world that's more lyrical, like a Terrence Malick film or a P.T. Anderson film, that made it different.
Where's he at?
I know he don't like surprises. And if he's wanting to see somebody, he'll find them.
How'd they come by this money? How'd they come by it? I'm right here!
I want to ask you about that specifically because I did read a quote from the director, David Rosenthal, where he mentioned putting together a lookbook that included references to some of the movies that he thought of when he was putting this film together and that he thought were good touching off points. And I was curious whether or not you watched that. Did he share that with you or anyone else in the cast? And if so, did you find that helpful?
He did. And it helped me make a decision to do the movie. It was very helpful to watch that, actually. Yeah.
Was it more in terms of broader choices the character made or specific scenes where you kind of had an instinct?
It was more tonally what the film would be, that we were on the same page of how the film should be and look.
No. No.
In anticipation of this interview, I threw out to our listeners on Twitter and asked them to name their favorite Sam Rockwell performance. And there are a lot of good movies. There are a lot of good performances. I expected to get some variety, maybe 5 or 6 different films that would really crop up over and over again. And it turned out I got 14 different answers, and many of them multiple times. I think it says something about the career you've had, the success you've had, but also the types of roles you've chosen.
Gertie! Gertie, come here!
What happened?
I don't know. Meteorites.
There have been no meteorites.
Micrometeorites, maybe. I don't know. Either way, there might be damage.
Is there anything in the roles you've chosen that unifies them? That you see a common theme?
The closest thing I've done to single shot is a movie like Moon.
Not that I don't believe you, Gertie, but, I mean, you know, this thing is springing leaks like an Acme fire hose. You need to let me go outside and fix this problem, Gertie.
I can't let you go outside, Sam.
Gertie, if you don't let me go outside, we can't fix this leak.
I'm not permitted to let you go outside.
We'll keep it between you and me, okay, pal?
Or lawn dogs. For Snow Angels, as far as the isolation of the character, maybe conviction.
Hey.
I'm Officer Nancy Taylor. I need you to come with me.
I'd love to, but I'm already spoken for.
Where'd you get those scratches?
Look around you, sweetheart. See the branches?
Sir, I need you to step into the patrol car.
My grandpa needs this tree out of here.
Now, Mr. Waters, put down the chainsaw.
I tell you what, Buttercup, why don't you go give out some parking tickets and then come back when I'm done? How's that?
Put down the chainsaw.
I've done some darker characters like this, but tonally it's like a Travis Bickle, Tender Mercies kind of Martin Sheen, Badlands kind of thing.
I was thinking about that, specifically watching this film, that sense of loneliness and isolation, and you mentioned some of the roles recently, but especially a movie like Moon, Snow Angels, those characters, they make choices to be that way, but at the same time, they are all striving to make some kind of connection. In all three cases there, of the ones we've mentioned, including A Single Shot, they're trying to reconnect with family, so it's not totally by choice that they are separated and lonely. And you talked about how you've made these choices, but have you thought about what attracts you specifically to those types of characters?
Well, they're just fun to act. It's fun to go to that place, you know, and explore that kind of darkness inside of you. And I find it really cathartic, you know.
Well, to push it a little bit further, I was thinking of roles you've played like in Galaxy Quest and Charlie's Angels and Confessions of a Dangerous Mind to a certain extent. These are all characters where you're really high energy, you're very charismatic, sometimes you're really goofy.
Oh, this is so good. This next act answers the age-old question. If you wear a cellophane, if you wear a cellophane suit, can people clearly see you're nuts? I don't know. A little humor, folks.
And then you go to these recent films we touched on where it's much darker, as you said. It's much more subdued. And I guess I'm curious if one is more natural for you to play. I guess another way of asking it would be, are you the life of the party in real life, Sam, or are you the guy who kind of goes sits in the corner and broods?
It depends what kind of mood I'm in. If I've had a lot of sleep and I've maybe had a couple of tequilas, I might be the life of the party. And if I'm tired and I'm stressed and rushed, maybe I'll be a little more solitary.
You've worked with Martin McDonagh on stage and also recently in Seven Psychopaths, and I interviewed him for that film, and we talked about you and Christopher Walken specifically, what it was like for him to work with you guys. And I described you overall as an actor, but especially that character Billy, as someone who's so charismatic and seems on the surface to be really harmless, but there's always that flicker of danger behind what he's doing. And I want to play real quick here what he had to say about that. You've worked with Sam Rockwell and Christopher Walken previously with your play, A Behanding in Spokane, and I've always loved Sam Rockwell on screen. He actually may capture the spirit of what we were talking about in terms of that, the competing psyche of dark and light, better than any actor on screen, because he's so charismatic and so smart and seems harmless a lot of times, but there's always that flicker of danger behind just about every character he plays. Is that something that you respond to in him?
Yeah, and this especially taps into all of that. You know, it's a character who is, I think, hilariously funny, but can go to any place at any given moment. And he was that way in the play that we did, as was Christopher. Christopher Walken is someone who can be hysterically funny and terrifying on a dime. They can both spin on that. And so it's interesting having a couple of guys like that in one film, because even writing the characters, I didn't know where they were going to take me from minute to minute. And having those two actors on board helped with that immensely.
So my question for you is whether or not you are naturally attracted to those types of characters, not only in the roles you choose, but the films you watch.
Yeah, that's a very nice thing to say.
He was very complimentary.
He's a great guy. He's just one of the great writers and directors around. You know?
Mm-hmm.
He's amazing. And his material really lends itself to, it's very actor-friendly, you know. They're vibrant characters.
Yeah, I think that specifically that actually segues nicely into my next question, because they're very verbal. Obviously, he's a very talented writer and his characters talk a lot. And as we were talking about some of those funnier roles you've played, those are performances that require you to plow through a lot of dialogue. And then you go to some of these darker films and they ask you to be much more expressive and rely on physicality and your face. This one, obviously, a single shot falls into that camp. Is there something that appeals to you about one versus the other?
I guess it's like playing baseball or basketball. You know, it's a different sport to some degree. You know, it's like it's a different part way of moving your body or moving your instrument. It's fun to change it up, you know.
Yeah.
Do a little boxing, do a little baseball, a little basketball, you know.
I want to ask you about one of your co-stars in particular here, Jeffrey Wright. I mean, this is one of those actors who's one of the all-time scene stealers probably in cinema. He can make a lot out of a little, and he plays your longtime friend Simon here, who we see the relationship's a little bit more complicated than maybe on the surface. I don't want to spoil anything, but there is that extended confrontation scene with him where Jeffrey Wright doesn't play that character as just really, really drunk. He plays him almost as if his entire soul is in anguish.
What are you doing, General? Oh, good, General. You got a gun on me.
Yeah, how about that?
And I just was curious if you could walk us through a scene like that with an actor like that. Is that a case where you've rehearsed that extensively ahead of time? Is it kind of improv'd and you're just out on a wire with him and you see where it goes?
Well, he came in very prepared, and those are all lines from the script. There were a few ad-libs, but actually taken from the book. He kind of saved our ass, because the main scene that he has has a lot of exposition, and he really stepped up to the plate, and he just knocked it out of the park.
What was it specifically about him and that role of Simon that so appealed to you?
Well, I think it's everything you were just saying. He makes it look easy. He makes it look like he's ad-libbing, because he's so loose and relaxed, but he's, you know, ever since I saw him in Top Dog, Underdog, you know, on Broadway and at the Public Theater with Don Cheadle, you know, he's so relaxed. He's like Marlon Brando or Javier Bardem. You know, he's just incredible to watch.
You mentioned not only Jeffrey complimenting him, but Javier Bardem. Are there any actors on your wish list, sort of, that it almost doesn't matter what the project is, you would be in a film with them?
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. I mean, there's a lot of great actors out there, and I've had some opportunities. And I mean, Philip is somebody, Phil Hoffman, Liev Schreiber, and Meryl Streep, Kate Blanchett, you know, I mean, so many great people out there, you know.
On the flip side of that, you mentioned David Rosenthal here and kind of his vision being a big selling point for you. How much for you does the director matter in terms of as you're weighing everything? Sometimes if the role is one that really appeals to you and you really like the dialogue, is that something that you'll overlook, maybe not completely trusting a director, or is that crucial?
Sometimes you have to take a leap of faith, but it's very important. You know, you just kind of have to get a sense, and sometimes you got to take a chance, you know, and just go for it, you know. Sometimes it's hard.
I wanted to ask you here in closing about a film I know you have coming out, the film you worked on with Lynn Shelton.
Yes, Laggies.
You know, she's someone who obviously is known for working in a real improvisatory way and kind of letting scenes just develop there. Is that something you did with that film specifically, and was it something that appealed to you?
I did it to work with her because I'm a big fan of hers and to work with Keira Knightley. That was the main reason. It was a bonus to work with Chloe Moretz. I mean, she's really fun to work with, Lynn Shelton. Yeah, we've totally, we're on the same page, you know.
Well, Sam, you've been a show favorite here since our inception 8 years ago. You come up a lot and always with very high praise. So it's been a thrill to talk with you. Thanks so much for your time. Best of luck with the movie.
Thank you, man. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
Thank you very much.
My thanks again to Sam Rockwell. Certainly not the most in-depth interview we've ever had here on the show, Josh, but still a real thrill to talk with him. A Single Shot is out in Chicago and select theaters now. You can also catch it on cable on demand or rent it via a bunch of digital streaming sites as well, including Amazon, YouTube, Vudu, and Google Play.
Masker Theater is up next. Now that Adam's voice is back, we'll give him a bit more than the two words he had in last week's edition. Plus, we'll get his thoughts on 2001. You know he's going to take issue with something I said last show. And we'll also go way, way back from 2001 to 1993 and ask listeners about the best films of that year in the Film Spotting poll. Stay with us.
I've heard love songs make a Georgia man cry. On the shoulder of somebody's Saturday night. Read the good book, studied it too. But nothing prepared me for living with you. Lock me up tight in these shackles I wear. Tied up the keys in the folds of your hair. And the difference with me is I used to not care. Man to the ways of the world. Now I've traded those lessons for faith in a girl. Across the ocean, a thousand years from my home. In this frozen old city of silver and stone. Ships in the harbor, birds on the bluff.
Hey everyone, want to just jump in here with a quick reminder that Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
This episode is also presented by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 20% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM9. If you want an example of a very nicely designed Squarespace website from a Film Spotting listener, we give you this note from Kabir right here in Chicago. I learned about Squarespace from listening to Film Spotting about 18 months ago. I run a hair salon in Wicker Park, and we were unhappy with the web designer we were using, so I suggested to the owner that we try the site, and we haven't looked back. We found a clean and crisp template that goes with the style of the salon, and it's really user-friendly to update content. Plus, we integrate Instagram and Facebook. It saved us a lot of money, we have the annual plan, and time, the back-and-forth emails with the old designer. What more can I ask? Thank you, Film Spotting. Thank you, Kabir, for that nice note and testimonial. If you want to check out Kabir's website, it's Milano Hair Design Studio. That's Milano-HDS. squarespace.com. Some of the key features that Squarespace offers that I know many of our listeners out there with sites currently, maybe looking to change providers and different hosts, or you're looking to build one from scratch. Events collections. You can keep track of TV premieres and movie releases with the Squarespace calendar feature. They're also constantly improving their platform with new features and new designs and even better support, but they do have very sleek designs ready for you to start with and all the style options you need to create a unique website for you or your business. It all starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for 1 year. And every design automatically includes a mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website. So no matter your content, it will look great on every device all the time.
You don't need a credit card to start your trial. You can just begin building your own website. And then if you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM9 to get 20% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. Ships in the harbor, birds on the blood. Don't lose an inch when their anchor goes up. And the difference with me is I'm falling in love. Stop home, let me go.
Mr. Payne, sir, you know, every second that you could let us out early would really increase our chances of survival.
It's like our sergeant told us before one trip into the jungle. Men, 50 of you are leaving on a mission. 25 of you ain't coming back.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That was Wiley Wiggins as Mitch Kramer, failing to convince Julius Tenen's Mr. Payne to let them leave school early in 1993's Dazed and Confused, of course, from writer-director Richard Linklater. And yes, Wiley Wiggins did touch his nose there approximately 17 times, so everyone needs to take 17 drinks. The movies in this week's Film Spotting poll question face even tougher odds than that, though. We're going to look ahead to next week's show and our top five films of 1993. We're going back to something we've done here on the show for the past 3 or 4 years, our year-by-year countdown. It started, Josh, with the year 2004, which was the year before Film Spotting began, and we've gone back and revisited those years and shared our top five movies. It's been a little over a year since we did another one of these lists, and it works out well, actually, because it will be the 20-year anniversary of each of those movies.
And we were just talking about what a rich year that was, yeah. Looking back at it. Sometimes you wonder, am I going to remember enough films from this year? And just looking, we had two Spielbergs, we had a Scorsese picture that year, and a bunch of other stuff. So, yeah, this will be fun.
I think it will be a good list. It's time now, though, for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, special guest Michael Phillips and I massacred this.
Oh, dear. You're staring at my dress. I should explain. I'm going to the choreographer's ball tonight. That is a prize for the best costume.
And we always win.
I'm not so sure about tonight. I'm supposed to be the Grand Duchess Anastasia. But I think I look more like Tugboat Annie. What do you think?
Well,
now be cruel. Be brutal. Because heaven knows they will. Well, what do you think, Mr. Bloom?
Where do you keep your wallet?
That was Christopher Hewitt as Roger, Zero Mostel as Max Bialystock, and Gene Wilder as Leo Bloom in 1968's The Producers, written and directed, of course, by Mel Brooks.
Austin Luger in Carmel, Indiana, wrote in, "It took me just a line or two to recognize this week is The Producers. The real question is, why did you pick this one? Is there some random bit of trivia I don't know about? Oh no, are they making a musical out of 2001? Is Matthew Broderick playing Hal? Are you just mad that Mel Brooks won the screenplay Oscar over Kubrick? Well, when it comes to the nuances of what compels mankind to resort to unthinkable primal violence, I'm pretty sure the guy who wrote, 'Don't be stupid, be a smarty, come and join the Nazi party,' deserves the trophy."
Sorry to confuse you there, Austin. Actually, I wouldn't be surprised if that 2001 musical is on its way, considering what they are making Broadway musicals out of. Eric Grebner from Decatur, Illinois, wrote in to say both It and 2001 came out in 1968. There you go. And Mel Brooks' screenplay beat that of Kubrick and Clark's at the 1969 Oscars. Besides that, the only other connection I could think of is that between the celebration of Nazis in Springtime for Hitler with the famous musical opening of 2001, whose composer, Richard Strauss, criticized the Third Reich subtly through his music, despite his appointment by that regime to the Nazi State Music Bureau.
Eric is speaking about things I know nothing about. That's not uncommon here when we get listener feedback, Josh, but I'm going to have to take his word for it there. Our tie-in was simply 1968, that's where we were going. And as you heard from Eric and Austin, the fact that Mel Brooks' screenplay did beat out Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke for 2001 A Space Odyssey, the film that was our sacred cow discussion last week on the show. Michael and Josh doing a great job there. If you want to hear that conversation, also their top five Stanley Kubrick scenes, you can get that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Reach into that hat, Josh. It is not very full. It should be easy. Not many listeners recognizing 1968's The Producers. Maybe it was something in your over-the-top performance. You did a great job, though, I think. You really were channeling Christopher
Hewitt. If anything, that helped him. I mean, come on.
I agree. But not many entries. Reach in. Pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Brent Cronin from Seattle, Washington.
Congratulations, Brent. Email feedback@filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
The real reason we're all happy that Adam has his voice back is that he can now take the meaty part for Massacre Theater this week. Massacre Theater is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Filmspotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
And new on Fandor, I know we have a lot of horror fans out there, Josh, and you can check out a new documentary that caught my eye, and I'm not even that big of a horror guy. It's called Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue. It's a comprehensive history of the American horror film that starts with Thomas Edison's version of Frankenstein and goes up through Saw and beyond. It examines how a lot of these creations were reflections of their time, so it charts the genre shift from Atomic Age anxieties and movies like Them and Vietnam-era violence and Night of the Living Dead all the way through the post-9/11 xenophobia of films like Hostel, with stops along the way at the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Camp Crystal Lake. It sounds really fascinating. That is available now on Fandor.com.
Yeah, that's right up my alley. Them, a recent top five nature movie for me.
Indeed it was. Let's get on to this week's scene, which does have a clear tie into a topic we're discussing on the show, as it usually does, though we're not really going to give you any more hints than that. I think this one's going to be a tough one. I think
yeah,
this is
think
another
so
one,
too.
Though, kind of like that scene from The Producers that's a little bit just detached from the rest of the film. I'm not sure the people will be able to hone in on it, but again, there is a connection to something that features prominently in this week's show, and we will note that there is a name of a character in the scene, and as we are wont to do from time to time, we have changed that name, and we have changed that name to help you a little bit with the tie-in. I think that's all we're going to say. Josh, I started off, so you're going to give me the action.
All right, here we go. And action.
How well do you know me?
Not that well, apparently.
Do you know me well enough that if I did something a little bit strange, maybe it was even a little bit dangerous, but I told you to trust me anyway, you think you could do that?
No.
Wow. That was honest. You're beautiful, you're kind, and you're painfully honest.
Who are you, and what did you do with Eric Knox?
It's the new me.
And
scene.
Can you talk that fast for the rest of the show? We'll be done really quickly.
I probably could, actually. That was kind of fun, I have to say. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, September 23rd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Also at filmspotting.net is where you can participate in our weekly poll questions. You already heard our results from last week, but now we've got a new challenge to pose to you. As we said at the top of this segment, we're going to look ahead to our top five next week, top five films of 1993. And what we like to do here with these poll questions, and really as we approach the whole top five, is we kind of think of it as a case where you can only keep five movies from that year. Which ones do you keep? Well, for the poll, we're going to make it even tougher. You can only save one movie to put away. All the other ones, they're going to be destroyed somehow, but this one can be put away. Which one do you choose? Josh, the options are
Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused.
Are you really not going to save McConaughey's Wooderson?
How about Harold Ramis working with Bill Murray on Groundhog Day?
Are you really not going to save Ned Ryerson?
Spielberg's Jurassic Park?
Are you really not going to save the dinosaurs after Spielberg went to the trouble to resurrect them?
How about Spielberg's Schindler's List?
We're not going to comment on that one. Let's just move to the next
not
option.
Not touching that, huh?
Nope.
Okay. Tony Scott's True Romance, penned, of course, by Quentin Tarantino.
Are you really not going to save that scene between Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper?
Oh, that is a cultural treasure there.
Your cantaloupe, it is indeed. Maybe just that scene should be one of the options in this week's poll question. So those are the five. We do acknowledge that maybe you're not a big fan of any of those films and you want to save something else, but there's no other. You got to pick which one of those five you're going to keep. We want to know what you think. Vote now at filmspotting.net.
That's the lovely sound of the screeching prehistoric apes slash humans from Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. They're fighting over the water hole there. But Adam, I could sense you were almost as angry having to sit here last show and listen to Michael Phillips and I discuss 2001 sidelined with your lost voice and not being able to get a word in edgewise. It seemed like it was probably pretty painful for you.
A little bit. It was fun, but it was also frustrating, I do have to say, because at one point I recognized that I was actually playing the role of Hal for your conversation. Yes. I was sitting in my usual spot across from you. I'm running all the controls so the show doesn't go without me. And I'm watching you guys facing each other, just like the scene where Hal is watching.
You're
them,
just reading our lips.
I'm reading your lips the whole time, but I can also hear you in this case. And yes, I was thinking maybe if they keep this up, if they keep up this great of a conversation, then I'm going to be permanently disconnected. I just don't even need to be here. So
we thought about it.
Frustrating, but still fun.
Well, it's only fair that you get a chance to weigh in here because we talked about this a lot in preparation about how this was a bit of a daunting prospect. A lot of times these sacred cows are, but this one in particular, and maybe the place to start was with a question that was prompted by a listener, actually, that Michael and I both had a chance to answer. The listener wondered, looking back at the film now, whether we would name it among our top 10 films of all time, because Michael joined us for our Sight and Sound show we did last year when we ended up forcing ourselves to make that list, the top 10 of all time, and we actually went ahead and listed our top 20. It wasn't in any of ours at that point. Seeing it again, I bumped 2001 into my top 20. How about you? Would you bump it into the top 20, perhaps the top 10?
It would definitely go in my top 20, and I think there would be a really good chance that if we had to sit down and do those Sight and Sound lists all over again, that it would, in fact, make my top 10.
So really good experience with
really
it, revisiting
great experience watching 2001 again. And we did have that poll question that came up in the discussion. How do you take 2001? Do you consider it a masterpiece that's a movie you genuinely love, or is it a masterpiece you find mystifying? And I wrote that option because that was really where I stood on 2001. As I've said a few times now, it was a case where I saw it as a freshman in college. I know it was late at night. I was watching on a little TV in my dorm room. And my recollection of that experience was that I really didn't process the movie at all. And so I was thinking about the daunting task of sitting down again and watching what Stanley Kubrick was presenting and really feeling like I'm going to be lost. How much am I really going to understand what's going on? I know I'm going to respond positively to the visuals, but am I going to find it ultimately mystifying and kind of have a detached experience with it? And what I found rewatching it, Josh, was that whatever experience I had back in college, I can barely even count that as seeing the film. Hmm. I literally must have been just zoning in and out late at night and not really paying attention to what was going on, because the biggest thing I took away from it was actually how unmystifying the movie was, how straightforward I thought 2001 was. There's no point in this film, maybe up to the last 20 minutes, which we'll get to, where I was ever questioning what was going on or why a character was doing something they were doing or how the story was playing out. I always knew exactly what was happening. Yes, it's a little vague, of course. It's mysterious. It's not your simple cause and effect chain of events, A plus B plus C, that you get in a lot of classical Hollywood cinema. But it's pretty close, actually. And even the last 20 minutes, I think you could probably make a case, aren't as challenging on their face as they seem. I mean, at some point, clearly, the Dave Bowman character goes to Jupiter and beyond the infinite and starts encountering later versions of himself, including seeing himself in death. And having gone through that process, we get that rebirth of the Star Child. And I don't know how else you read it other than sort of the new evolution of man. So I'm not saying I know exactly what Stanley Kubrick is suggesting. At the same time, it's not that hard to follow.
It's a fairly straightforward narrative, and maybe that's what we forget when we get away from the film. Perhaps, as a college student, you aren't used to the pacing. Why are we spending 10 minutes watching this spaceship dock? I mean, that could throw you off. And then I do think, although I agree with you in your reading of the narrative trajectory of the final 20 minutes, the mystification comes in wondering, okay, so what does this mean now?
How do I process that? Mm-hmm. What do I think he's trying to say, or how do I want to interpret it? Ultimately, you're right, that's going to be a personal choice that a lot of different people have to make. I was still surprised, though, at just how kind of simple, frankly, I thought 2001 was. And there was enough there from a plot standpoint and a story standpoint to ground me and carry me through the entire film. It wasn't just a case of the dazzling visuals. One of the questions that you posed to Michael in setting up the conversation, you read that email from Christopher Reese, a listener, where he was talking about the fact that it is just that. It's this brilliant visual film, a technical marvel, but there's not a lot of meaning there. And you guys really got into that a little bit. I guess my response to that, Josh, is that I would tell Chris, I think there's a significant difference between a work of art being meaningful and a work of art being explainable. And as we've said, there are some things in 2001 that maybe just aren't explainable at all and never could be. I mean, think about those last 20 minutes. That's a case where Kubrick is going to a place where he is completely making it up as he goes along. This is his creation, whereas everything else that he's showing in the future, that's all nevertheless rooted in some science, right? He got together with a lot of leading scientists in the field and tried to extrapolate, tried to envision what the future would be like, and it was grounded in a lot of reality.
There are familiar elements there,
there
even
are.
To the world of 1968.
Exactly. Once you get to Jupiter and beyond, then Kubrick is going off into his own speculative realm there. I mean, we are really going into another dimension. How could anyone know what that might be like? So we're not really going to get any answers there. But what we see in The Dawn of Man, that first use of technology, a tool being made into a weapon and resulting in the first murder, the first conquering of territory through physical force, which we get there in that watering hole sequence, then we're catapulted into space to see a glimpse of that conquering spirit in man, that harnessing of technology that was groundbreaking and truly futuristic for 1968, but I think is still groundbreaking and feels futuristic for 2013. And then we watch the human conflict with technology, where the tool becomes smarter and more devious and actually more human, right? It becomes imperfect. It has malfunctions. It will do anything to survive. What else defines the human spirit than that? And we see that in how all those things I'm repeating there because you guys covered it in a lot of detail, but that's meaning enough, I think, Josh, for 10 films. But it's in this one, and oh yeah, it's also shot and designed and edited and scored so masterfully that few films in the history of cinema, frankly, can compare. So you add those things together, that's where you get truly a masterpiece. I think you also add on the layer of meaning to it being potentially a warning to mankind that I think Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick are giving us, where you have this sense as they get into space that back then you took the tools and did something with them. But now the tools are controlling you. You're expanding into realms that you're just not really prepared for. You're out of your element in space and you're going to struggle. I mean, think about all that time we spend in space showing the characters having to learn how to do things like breathe differently, right? You can't breathe the same way in space. You can't walk the same way in space. You don't eat the same way in space. They're now in a new plane. They're in a new territory that requires them to completely relearn everything these millions of years have taught them, and they're out of their element, and things can go wrong. They're like the apes, again, in space, sort of pawing at the monolith. They have to learn all that stuff again. So it's not just a case at any point in this movie, are you just watching things to take in the visual pleasure of them? As far as I'm concerned, Josh, it's all of a piece that adds up to something much larger in terms of these key themes that Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke are dealing with.
That's intriguing that you use the word warning, because that indicates to me a certain optimism in the film, because if you're going to offer something as a warning, it's in the hope that things could change.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps that's Clark's influence a little bit, because Michael and I both spent time placing 2001 within the trajectory of Kubrick's career and noting how it seemed to be, and I'll speak for myself here, a confirmation and almost a culmination of his pessimism about the human race, about human civilization and its inability to get things right, even across different eras and with different technology, where it does always seem to lend towards the conquering that you're talking about, which is a good addition. I didn't touch on that, but the exploring in order to conquer, we do see that. But also just the idea of that it's going to lead toward murder and death eventually. And a warning to me is more of an optimistic interpretation of that, whereas I see the end of 2001 as being just another level of somehow, we don't get how this is going to happen, but even this Star Child is going to use whatever new powers it might have to continue to conquer or to kill, because I sense that being more fitting with Kubrick's overall pessimism that just seeps out of all of his movies, at least when it comes to the human condition.
Yeah, I get that. And I think you guys both rightfully said it. Human folly is not only the theme of this film, it's the theme of Kubrick's entire filmography. But I guess the slight distinction I would make, Josh, and where I disagree with you and maybe Michael a little bit, is that pessimism can lead to cynicism, and cynicism can lead to the absence of any hope, or maybe by definition means the absence of any hope or optimism. But I can't watch a Stanley Kubrick film, even with all of those sort of dark jokes and that examination of the folly of man without thinking that he wouldn't invest the time in it that he does and the care and explore those themes if it wasn't ultimately because of a deep reservoir of love for humanity.
What about A Clockwork Orange? That's the one I really want to revisit because I wonder if that's where we get to the point of cynicism.
Yeah, maybe
just
so.
From having seen it a long time ago, that's how it resonates with me in my memory. It may not be the case. It definitely deserves a revisit from me, but I wonder if Kubrick gets to that point there.
Maybe he does. And that is another film that I also saw back in college. I have a more vivid recollection of it than 2001, but need to revisit. And I don't know how many of these we're going to do with Stanley Kubrick.
I know, it's getting a little ridiculous at this point.
That's another sacred cow. That's another perfect candidate for a sacred cow discussion because I do need to see it again. But I go back to even movies like Full Metal Jacket, and it's all over the place. But there's this sense, I guess, watching Kubrick for me, Josh, that there's always a case of something that Joker, the Matthew Modine character, says explicitly in Full Metal Jacket. And maybe this is too on the nose, but it's always struck a chord with me. He says at one point, sort of jokingly, to a commanding officer who notes that he's got Born to Kill on his helmet, but also has a peace symbol. And he says, "What are you doing? That doesn't make any sense," basically. And he says, "It's the Jungian thing, sir. It's the duality of man," right? And he doesn't know what he's talking about and doesn't care and just wants him to remove it. But that seems to me, in essence, what Kubrick is all about. And there is that duality that he explores. And I think, unfortunately, that darker side, the Born to Kill side, tends to win out, which human history has shown us that. But the peace symbol is there not just to be a joke. It's there to be a little bit of a joke, but a reminder that we're also capable of that. So I think that Kubrick, for me, I want to imbue his films. I watch his films with a more generosity of spirit, I think, than maybe you do, who see only that cynicism.
You know where I actually see it? His final film, In Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
I see quite a bit of it in that movie towards the end. I mean, you get a lot of the cynicism, especially in terms of sexuality in that film, but I think I'd agree with you more about Eyes Wide Shut than maybe almost all of his other films. I mean, the early ones, Paths of Glory, I think you see a mourning where there's a hope for better from people still in Paths of Glory in an early film like that.
Yeah.
And then it does show up again in Eyes Wide Shut. But in 2001, boy, I found it to be pretty pessimistic.
Okay. Well, it is worth noting probably that as you were talking about the ending and the Star Child and how that's pessimistic. That did strike me during the review. I really wanted to jump in there as I was listening because that was a case where it seemed to me very hard to watch a sequence that is rebirth. I mean, literally rebirth, right? We're seeing this new organism come to life and to hear that music that goes with it and not feel some sense of hope or a sense of something triumphant in that. And watching the film, you want to then say, okay, maybe now that man has confronted his death head on and that everyman character that Bowman is, now somehow there's going to be a new evolution of man. Maybe there will be a new embodiment that is actually able to put that dark side behind. Who
maybe
knows?
But the bone sequence is given that same triumphant treatment.
It is, you're
for
right.
That prehistoric ape, that second, that discovery is as big for that creature as the discovery of the Star Child. And I think by using the similar music, Kubrick is putting those and holding them up together as similar moments.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The one does lead to death. The other, well, we don't find out in the film.
No, I can definitely see that. I guess if I really had the sense and the time and the intellect to break down the differences, I would suggest something along the lines of the apes encountering what they encounter isn't an apples to apples comparison to what man encounters at the end of the film, having gone through the process of Jupiter and beyond the infinite. Everything that Dave sees takes that human character through another round of evolution, and maybe it changes him. Maybe it does in a different way than the apes do. I don't
know. You're so hopeful, Adam. You're so hopeful.
Who knew that I was going to be Mr. Pollyanna here and looking for that sense of generosity, like I said. But you know what? Another thing that jumped out to me is I was thinking about Kubrick, and I was listening to your guys' top five, which I thought was a great top five. I mean, I don't want to sit here and pump your tires too much, but honestly, listening to you and Michael with that top five, that was one of my favorite top fives on the show in a long time.
We had a lot of good material to pick from, though.
And I think that Michael, he really made me feel bad because even though I liked your top five, and even though I thought my top five ultimately that I came up with was pretty good and reflected Kubrick's work in a pretty solid way, he did what I wanted to do and what I try to do with most top fives, Josh, which is pinpoint scenes that are really sort of more idiosyncratic, more personal, that I respond to in a way that maybe a lot of other film fans wouldn't. I think that's what makes the list unique and interesting to listen to. So, for example, if we look at our list, we had a lot of choices that were pretty famous Kubrick scenes. And Michael had one or two, but he also had scenes like The Killing, and he had the scene from Lolita, which is a small scene nobody talks about, I think, when they really focus on Kubrick. And the best one of all was he picked a scene from The Shining, which is that great maze sequence.
Right.
That is one of those smaller scenes, but nevertheless gives you such an insight, I think, into the characters in that movie and Kubrick as a whole and some of the technical things he does. And it's one I totally wouldn't have thought of at all. So I think you guys did a great job with that top five, and listening to it and made me think about his work in general. And one of the things that struck me, and maybe this is where I get the optimism from a little bit, is that there's always a sense that there's an individual fighting against an oppressive larger force that is just something they can't really defeat, which I guess is actually a negative thing. But the fact that the individual continues to strive for it is what I see as optimism. Think about Jack Nicholson. As bad of a character he is in a lot of ways, as bad of a man, if you want to argue he is, there's that force in that house that he is fighting against. There's the force that Joker is fighting against, the military and the impulse to kill and impulse for war that we get in Full Metal Jacket. You can go on and on, A Clockwork Orange. What these characters are fighting against, there's always this sometimes unseen force that they just can't defeat, but they're trying. They're trying sometimes. And you're right that the individuals sometimes aren't the best people themselves. They're not heroic. Often they're not heroes at all, but there's still that longing.
Well, let me ask you the question then. Whose side do you really think a Kubrick movie is on? Do you ever feel in those scenarios, which I'd agree with, that does describe a lot of his plots, that the movie is really on the side of that human protagonist? I always feel like more often than not, they're a pawn.
Yeah.
For this story.
No, I think you're right. I think you're saying it a different way, but I think they are largely pawns, but we still get the conflict and the drama of them rebelling against that force and striving against it. And I think it's just more complex than that. I think that's what makes Kubrick so fascinating. And I told you as well that after doing this top five, if you would ask me to rate my favorite filmmakers of all time, I'd have to put Stanley Kubrick in my top five easily now, whereas if you'd asked me 2 weeks ago or a month ago or 2 years ago, I would have certainly spoken highly of Kubrick. But it really was watching 2001 and going through all of his films again, even though I didn't get to rewatch them all, but watching a lot of scenes from his movies for the top five and recognizing just how many great films he's made, films that are essential. I would put 2001 in an essential category. I would put Dr. Strangelove as essential. And what I mean by that is, if you're going to talk about the top 25, 50, 100 films of all time that you think people need to see, whether you think they'll like them or not, who cares? Essential viewing. He's got at least three movies that belong in that conversation. And then I would put four or five others in the category of very good to great movies.
Well, and it's a batting average thing too, right? Considering the limited number of films he did make and how many of them are so good.
Yeah, for me, just rethinking Kubrick a little bit, like I said, watching 2001 again, it didn't really make me elevate him even higher in my estimation. One of the things that you guys talked about as well was whether there were any instances watching the film, any scenes, anything that stuck out to you as something that didn't work. Actually, were there any flaws, if you will, in this movie? And the only thing that jumped out to me, Josh, at all, and we talked about this a little bit off air and you see it a little bit of a different way, but I was struck a little bit by his use of technology. I go back to Elysium, something you said. We disagreed on that movie, but one of the things you rightfully pointed out is the movie just sort of takes for granted how technology is in the future. It doesn't spend a lot of time bogging you down in why it works or how it works. He doesn't really do that either, Kubrick in 2001, but he does dwell on it a lot. It's almost like he gets lost a little bit for me in some scenes, not enough to derail the movie for me, but there are some instances when that scientist character lands on the moon base, for example, and we get the video phone conversation. We get all these instances, the stuff on the Pan Am flight, where it really seems like Kubrick was so proud of all the research he'd done and how he was able to visualize what the future would look like in space that he's like, okay, I'm going to really force you to walk by the video phone and he's going to stop and make a call because I'm going to show you how it's going to be in the future. And there are a lot of instances like that where I wonder, okay, they catch your eye and they're sort of interesting and they make you talk. They give you something to converse about after the movie. Do they really serve the story or the larger themes that much? I'm not sure.
I did find a purpose in it, though, when we were talking about it. I think that it emphasizes the banality of these human characters and how they're using this technology.
Yeah. And there's a sense of that,
particularly
right.
Because two of those instances involve birthday greetings. In one, William Sylvester's scientist en route to the moon is calling his daughter to wish her happy birthday. And it's a very kind of obligatory action on his part. The mother who's there doesn't even come onto the screen because she doesn't care enough. You get the impression maybe she's out of the house. There's a reference to a nanny,
the babysitter's there,
something like that. So it's a very impersonal moment. And then later, one of the astronauts gets a birthday message en route to Jupiter from his parents, and he's barely bothering to look at the screen, or it might have been audio message, actually. So again, to me, it just emphasizes more of this pessimism about humanity is given this great technology, and do they even really use it to connect to each other? I think that may be why he lingers so long on those scenes, though I certainly understand there are so many science fiction movies that do get caught up in their technology and just are absorbed by it. And you're like, okay, I get it. Come on, move along. Yeah. I don't know that that's what's going on here.
No, I agree that there's no doubt that once we get to Jupiter and we see the way Dave and Poole are using technology or not using it, and the fact that they're sort of these slovenly characters who really, any sense of that conquering spirit of humanity has now sort of just resulted in them kind of being caretakers, right?
Yeah,
they're really there just to make sure everything's running
and stay in shape.
And stay in shape, which clearly they are. And so I think there is a sense of that, that if you're Hal and you're watching them and you're seeing how they live and eat and how they use technology, and you're saying, I've got a lot more on these guys than they have on me. Like, really, they're the ones in charge here? Come on. So I think there's no doubt that's there. But earlier in the film, watching the moon sequence, that was something that did jump out at me. Another thing I thought about was, what did you make of the Poole's death sequence? It's a very jarring, odd sort of cut where we see the pod closing in on him like it's going to cut his line or do something to hurt him. And then the next thing you know, it cuts to inside and we get Bowman's point of view. And we just see sort of a silly shot. For lack of a better word, it struck me as a little bit goofy of Poole floating very fast, him turning by the window. There was something very jarring.
You could almost miss it.
You could almost miss it, but jarring in kind of an absurd way, not jarring in a scary way.
I know what you mean. It is jarring. It's a little off. Something about it feels not right, but I can't believe that someone like Kubrick doesn't have an exact design about it. So you work overtime to try to figure it out. And the only thing I can think of is, again, it goes back to just this insignificant attitude the movie has towards the people, in that our perceptions as moviegoers, as humans, are so tied to these people that should be a major moment in the film,
right?
When we lose one of the quote-unquote main characters. There aren't really that many main characters. And what does Kubrick do? He just undermines that by essentially, you know what it feels like to me? A little bit like the way we'd flick a fly off our skin.
No, you're right.
Get out of here. And he goes off, just goes off into space. And the movie that cemented this a little bit for me watching for the list was Barry Lyndon.
Yeah.
In how many of the shots begin in medium shot on a single person or maybe two characters and then pull back slowly, slowly, slowly until we get these gorgeous landscapes. But what also happens there, not only do we get the landscapes, but the people become much
less significant
as that happens. And that's exactly what happens here, too, as he's floating off into space. He just matters less and less and less. I was honestly surprised that we even needed the rescue sequence, because at that point, the movie had clearly moved on.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I think you've got a great take on that scene. That's a good justification for it. It was the one scene in the entire film, though, for me that stood out, that felt like a moment where Kubrick just hadn't come up with the best way
visually
to handle it.
Yeah, could be.
It's the only one that feels like that in the entire film. So stuck out to me. Again, I'm really nitpicking here with a film, because that's what you have to do if you're going to find anything that really doesn't work. And I loved, again, Michael's phrasing, because I'm going to go back to this a lot. I'm probably just going to steal it and use it from time to time. I think it applies to any movie you ultimately like, but especially films of this nature that are a little bit more abstract, maybe a little bit more obtuse and require maybe a little bit more personal introspection as you watch it. But he talked about it being the kind of film that just casts a certain spell over you, and it either does or it doesn't.
Oh,
and
sure.
I don't begrudge anyone who watches 2001 and doesn't fall under its spell. I absolutely fell under its spell, though, watching it this time. I did. So with that closes out our discussion of 2001 for now. Though, actually, you know what? It doesn't quite, because in bonus content, Josh, this week, if you have the Film Spotting app for Windows or iPhone or Android, all the information about that bonus content and our apps you can find at filmspotting.net and click on apps. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about something very specific you said in your discussion of 2001. And a feeling that I have, Josh, as much as you seem to like and respect Kubrick and his films, sometimes I feel like you don't give him quite enough credit. So we're going to get into that.
Interesting.
In the bonus content.
Sofia Coppola, Liberace, zombies, and flopping fish heads. It's a bit of a mixed bag in our review roundup of movies just out now on DVD and VOD. You'll get a month's worth of film spotting in the next 15 minutes. Stay with us.
On a lark, on a whim, I said there's two kinds of men in this world and you're neither of them. And his fist cut the smoke. I had an eighth of a second to wonder if he got the joke. And in the car headed home, she asked if I had considered the prospect of living alone with a stain held in my eye. I had to summon the confidence needed to hear her goodbye. And another brief chapter without any answers blew by. And the songs that she sang in the shower are stuck in my head like Bring Out Your Dead. In bed. And experience robs me of hope that you'll make it back.
Time for our favorite part of the show, thank yous, where we acknowledge our donors, people have donated for the first time this week, or maybe who are donating again, as well as acknowledge some new monthly subscribers. We have four donors to thank this week. We start with a gold level film spotting donor.
That would be Charles from Sherman Oaks, California.
Longtime supporter of the show, listener of the show, and a very successful writer out there in LA. Thank you, Charles. Two new $5 a month subscribers.
Kevin from Wheaton, Maryland, and Brian from Indianapolis.
We also go to another Charles in a place that sounds like it should be California, but it is not.
Orange Beach, Alabama.
There you go. Thank you very much, Charles, Brian, Kevin, and Charles again out there in Sherman Oaks, and to all of our listeners who sent some of your hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. And again, we don't acknowledge every subscriber, but we have lots of $2 a month, $5, and $10 a month donors out there that really are the lifeblood of the show. If you can't donate or just aren't ready to commit to the show on that level yet, something you can do to help is rate us on iTunes. We've been noting this recently, and it has helped. We've seen those numbers go up. I think we've added something like 60 new reviews.
Excellent.
New ratings over the past few weeks.
Were they positive?
Most of them.
Okay, good.
Most
even
of
better.
Them. Yeah. I try not to read them. I don't need that negativity. But actually, no, I'm joking because honestly, I have to say thank you to all of our listeners who have rated us. We have a pretty solid 4.5 out of 5-star
nice.
Rating on iTunes. So we do appreciate that. And it does help the show. It helps get our show in front of potential new listeners. And it just takes a second. You don't have to write a review. You can just write a quick blurb or even just give us a 5-star rating. We will take it. We'd like to get to 1,000 here before the end of the year. So again, just go to iTunes and rate us. We do appreciate it. We also did want to give a quick bit of appreciation for our featured artist this week, Jason Isbell. He's been featured on the show before. These are tracks from his album released earlier this summer, Southeastern. Isbell and his band will be on tour in October, starting in the Southeast, in South Carolina, Georgia, and his home state of Alabama. And then he's going to get to Chicago on October 26th. More information at jasonisbell.com.
In a room by myself, looks like I'm here with a guy that I judge worse than anyone else. So I pace and I pray.
Hey, I'm Ellen Page.
And I'm Diablo Cody.
We are the actor and writer of the film Juno, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Nikki! Kate from Vanity Fair is here. Can I get you something to drink?
So, how is Sam related?
We've adopted her.
I was friends with her mother.
Mom,
and
this is my interview.
Okay. Yeah, so she has been living with us. We met when my parents divorced, and now my mom homeschools all of us. Based on the philosophy of the secret, which is based on the laws of attraction.
Can I talk, please?
Sure.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and this is the point in the show where we would normally share the Film Spotting Top 5, but a little bit of an odd week for us, and we are going off the grid, off our usual format a little bit, and we're going to share some quick reviews of movies that are out now on DVD. They just came out this past Tuesday, or they're coming out this Tuesday on DVD. These are movies that Josh has seen, or I have seen, in one case we both have seen, but we didn't get a chance to really discuss them in any detail on the show. Maybe they haven't come up at all on the show, and one of them is the movie you just heard a clip from there, The Bling Ring. This is the new movie from Sofia Coppola, and Josh, if you had said to me, is Film Spotting going to review the latest Sofia Coppola film? I would have said, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think for a while it was on the calendar because going back to previous co-hosts here, we've always been fans of her work. We discussed Somewhere, her most recent film. We discussed Marie Antoinette and very much liked that film. So The Bling Ring was one we had tabbed, and yet it somehow just didn't quite fit into our schedules. But you did see it. You wrote about it on your website. I have not had a chance to see it yet. Do you encourage me to seek it out?
Yeah, it's too bad we didn't get a chance to talk about it because I think there's a lot here. It's probably, for me, on the level of Somewhere. I mean, it feels a little less than, say, Lost in Translation. And I think we have a lot of expectations now on mm-hmm. Sofia Coppola, which is good. I mean, we should have those. This does have the same sort of heavy-lidded camera that she brings to a lot of her pictures.
Heavy-lidded. I like that. Slow.
Slow seems kind of like the wrong word for it, but it does bring things a little more down in a way that's not dull, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so what she's looking at here, it's similar in subject matter in a way to Somewhere in that it's LA set. It's this group of teens. It's based actually on a real case that was first written about in Vanity Fair in 2009, where these kids they'd break into celebrity homes and throw a little party, steal some jewelry, and then go off clubbing wearing the clothes that they had just stolen. And that's the interesting thing here is how Coppola captures that for these kids. What they're trying to steal is a lifestyle. I mean, they're obsessed with celebrities. They follow them on gossip sites. That's how they find out they're not home. They know what parties these people are going to and when they're going to be out of town. And so these kids are trying to live that life. And this is a really good cast. That's what made it a little bit more compelling to me than the surface things it's touching on. It doesn't go much deeper for me than what I just described, but you do have Katie Chang playing the ringleader here, and she's kind of this, good kid, you would think. She's so polite about being a kleptomaniac that you just kind of accept it. You also have Israel Broussard playing Mark, who becomes her right-hand man, and he has a desperation to why he gets involved in this that's actually pretty touching and I think speaks to a lot of the high school experience. And also really fun was Emma Watson in a bit part. She is the one who really nails the celebrity obsessiveness behind all this. Her character, it's almost like she has this plan from the start. Once they get caught and they get arrested and they have court dates, she treats the court date as like her runway. When she's going into court, she's all done up. It's like she's been waiting for this. And sure enough, eventually she's in negotiations for her own reality show about it. So it's this self-fulfilling prophecy that Coppola captures, and Watson in particular gives real bite.
You know what? I have a great idea. Why don't you come work for me?
As what?
Well, you could be my secretary.
I don't type.
Hell, Scott, I can pay people to type. I need a companion, a bodyguard, someone to keep people off my back, someone I can talk to the way we talk tonight. You be my right-hand man. You can take care of the animals. Please, say yes, Scott.
That was a clip from Behind the Candelabra, starring Michael Douglas as Liberace and Matt Damon as Scott Thorson, who would become Liberace's assistant and eventually lover. This is a Steven Soderbergh picture that premiered on HBO, and knowing that you are a bigger Soderbergh fan than I am, I figured you wouldn't let this pass. So I think, Adam, you saw it when it was airing on HBO.
I did.
Is it something that is going to push off Soderbergh's other film from this year, Side Effects, as the best of 2013 for you?
No, it's certainly not one of the best films for me of 2013. It's not going to push off Side Effects, which was, at the halfway point, my number one of the year. In terms of Soderbergh's overall body of work, it's probably actually somewhere in the middle. I mean, the guy's made how many movies now? Certainly more than 20. This is a good film, certainly one I recommend, but I can probably think of 12 Soderbergh films I do enjoy more. As you noted, I am a big fan of his work, though. There is some connection to some of his recent work, though, including Side Effects. And when I watched this movie, I wanted to read up a little bit on the Scott Thorson character. When you get to the end of it, you just kind of want to know where this guy is now and what his story is. And it turns out there's a lot the movie didn't cover, of course. And I read this quote in a Guardian article where an adoptive father character to him says about him that Scott's approach to communicating with people is always to play it in a manner that reflects best on him. And I love that line because having watched and loved and considered Side Effects, that I think is at the core of a lot of Soderbergh's recent work, but even some of his older films as well. I think you can go back to Sex, Lies, and Videotape. When you watch Behind the Candelabra, you recognize that it's not just Scott, it's also Liberace. These characters are people who see exactly what they want to see, they hear exactly what they want to hear, and they act in a way at all times that really is just about trying to make themselves look as good as possible or to get whatever they want. These are all really needy, selfish, desperate people. And that comes through in all the performances. Michael Douglas is really, really good here as Liberace. He's got this charismatic combination of magnanimity and monstrousness in every single encounter where you watch him and you think, I can absolutely see why anybody would be seduced by him. At the same time, you are often repelled by him, and I think that's a really fine line to walk. But Soderbergh also does something really interesting here, Josh, that he had to do, I think, and it's a credit to him and I think a credit to Douglas, where when he shows Michael Douglas playing the piano, it's not just close-ups of his hands that were clearly inserted shots of somebody else. They worked on this, and there are a lot of medium shots or wider shots where you can see Douglas's hands doing the work. And if you watch the movie and you don't really believe that the character you're watching, that his hands don't seem as though they were touched by God, then you're never going to believe why a character like Liberace would be able to become so popular, that the American people would fawn all over him the way he did, that someone like Scott Thorson would fall for him the way he did. So that's a really good choice that they make. And I think here, ultimately, though, it's Matt Damon who really steals the show even more than Douglas's Liberace, because that desperateness, that neediness, it comes through in a way where it just feels like it's in every pore of his body.
Is there a little of Ripley in this performance?
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
Yeah,
like
it sounds
Ripley.
Like it, you as you describe it.
It felt to me, though, more like I was watching Matt Damon on screen for the first time.
Huh.
There's something I've always felt a little bit self-conscious about Damon as a performer, even though I've liked many of his roles, and I really felt that stripped away here. And I think that it just is something instead that doesn't distract. It feels like it's part of this Scott Thorson character who's that self-conscious and who is that desperate. So he's really good here. I think he's going to come up as we get to our best performances of the year, at least on my list. I'm not sure the Academy and others will remember him quite as fondly as I do. But people who watch this, and Josh, when you finally do catch up with it, the one thing I'm curious to hear from people on is where they fall on Rob Lowe's character and also Dan Aykroyd a little bit. They have very minor roles in the film. Rob Lowe plays basically kind of this sleepy-eyed Norma Desmond type character. That's what he's doing with his face. He's a plastic surgeon, plays this really famous plastic surgeon who's the guy who performs plastic surgery not only on Liberace but on Scott Thorson to make him look more like Liberace, and he prescribes him drugs to lose weight. Turns out it's cocaine, which does amazing things for you if you're not taking it. There's something about it that just is crossing the line for me maybe a little bit in terms of it becoming a parody, in terms of it feeling like a caricature, feeling too goofy for this film. And Dan Aykroyd's character, he's Liberace's manager, feels a little too SNL that way as well to me. But I still found them pretty fascinating to watch. And overall, the film is definitely one that I think, like I said, fits into Soderbergh's recent body of work really well. And the performances are really good.
I'm scared.
Connie, there's a helicopter waiting for us on the roof. Keep your eyes on Mommy and Daddy, okay?
How do we know they're coming?
They're coming.
That's a scene from World War Z starring Brad Pitt. Just came out on DVD here September 17th. Another one that we didn't get to review on the show. Another one that I still haven't had time to catch up with. But Josh, I know that you were a fan of this movie. And as I saw previews for it, I couldn't help but think, do we really need another zombie movie right now? Because that's essentially what it is. He plays a UN employee who is trying to get to the bottom of this pandemic that is obviously affecting the entire world, threatens humanity as we know it. And I saw some of those clips where Brad Pitt's a father and he's got a young family and he's got a wife who he has to leave. And it's all very emotional. And as a father myself, I'm watching that and I'm watching some of the scenes of intense kind of action and violence with the zombies. And I'm thinking, you know what? That might just be actually too kind of overwhelming for me. I'm not sure I'm that excited to see this incarnation, this version of a zombie movie. But as I mentioned, you were a fan of it. Why is this a film that people should seek out?
It is pretty intense. I mean, you do get that from it. The surprise for me is that this is a little B picture. I mean, you heard about the bloated budget and the production troubles, and it's coming in as this globe-trotting epic with a huge star. The last thing I expected, and I was anticipating it just because, you know, it's a zombie movie. I like those. The last thing I expected was for this thing to be relatively sleek and quick. You don't get a lot of background on this epidemic that's outbreaking. You don't get a lot of science. You don't get a lot of logistics. Instead, you get some great set pieces that show you where the entrance is, where the exit is, where the danger is, and then it just lets it all break loose. And it was fun to watch that, especially with someone like Pitt in the middle of it, because we usually get these with an unknown face and a low budget. And so it was refreshing to see this done at this big of a scale. Now, this doesn't really get to any, you know, socio-political commentary that so many zombie films do. It's pretty simple on that level too, but you don't always need that. And so I got a scene with a zombie being inside a commercial airliner mid-flight, and just having that is kind of summer fun. People have been criticizing this summer as being horrible for Hollywood films, and I wouldn't consider it that bad when you get something like World War Z. We've talked at length about your film of the year so far, Adam, Side Effects from Steven Soderbergh. We haven't spent much time on the movie I would still place as number one. That's Leviathan documentary. That's going to be on DVD September 24. So I just wanted to get your feel from it because I know you didn't have as good of an experience with the film. And it's a strange film. You talked about someone coming out of 2001 and just not being able to give themselves over to it and understanding that. I'm going to try to be that way with you and to be generous, because I understand why someone might not want to sit down with nothing but darkness and strange sounds and clanging, the sound of water, maybe a light here or there to allow us a glimpse of some piece of machinery doing something, because that's primarily what we get with Leviathan, which is this immersive documentary set on a fishing trawler at work. We don't get many people. We get a lot of fish heads and flopping fish. We get some birds. We get things off in the darkness. For me, it was just this amazing amalgamation of the elements of cinema that also managed to create, maybe because we were forced to look for them, mini dramas throughout. Wasn't so dramatic for you, though.
No, it wasn't. And I think the line I had back when you named it your number one film of the year so far is that it's a cinematic experiment that I think is maybe more engaging and provocative to discuss than to watch. And I think there is a lot to discuss with it. But you're right, it's about the experience you have. Can't blame anyone who has a completely different one with a film like this. I think there is something you can equate to 2001. And going back to that Michael Phillips phrase, if you fall under the spell of Leviathan, if you find transcendence in the tedium, if you find mystery in the mundane, in the monotony, then this film is going to be a grand success. This experiment will be a grand success. I never had that revelatory moment. It never happened. I kept waiting for it, and it just never really clicked for me. That said, you have to appreciate a film that includes in the name of the credits. I'm wondering if you caught this. It includes literally as a credit, and I know I'm not going to say this right, but bear with me, Placopectin Magellanicus. That's a credit.
The scientific name for the...
say the scientific sure. name for the Atlantic yeah. sea scallop. That is on the same footing as the directors of the film. So this is where the filmmakers are coming from, mm-hmm. right? Is they're putting this creature and saying this is as much a star of the film as anybody else. This is really what the film's about. So I did appreciate that. And I appreciated being exposed to a world I've never really seen before. I think that's what great documentaries do. But then not only that, you're being immersed in it in the way nobody has seen before, because of the way they're using these smaller cameras to really put you in it. So I did respond to all of that on some level. There's one scene in the movie that I know a few different critics have had a differing opinion about, and it's something you haven't talked about, Josh. I don't think you did anyway when it came up during the top five. There's a scene involving the TV show The Deadliest Catch. There's a character, I think it might be the captain, but either way, it's definitely a fisherman on board this boat who is just sitting there looking exhausted. And you never see the TV. The camera just stays focused on him, but you hear the TV. And you hear this show that I don't even know what channel it's on, I'm sorry, but you hear this Discovery Channel show or whatever called The Deadliest Catch, and there's a commercial, there's a promotion for another episode, and it says something like, pain, exhaustion, heavy weather, and brotherhood. And you talk about drama, they're trying to sell the drama of this scenario, right? But what we're seeing on the face of this fisherman, who's watching it without any reaction at any point, is pain and exhaustion and the toll of the weather. We're not seeing any brotherhood at that point. We're just seeing the real drama shorn of any of that TV editing or TV music to make it something more than it is. And what you realize in that moment is that we've just got done watching 80 minutes of real pain and exhaustion. So even though it's a little bit too on the nose in a way that they had to make it that explicit, the connection between the real life drama and the fake drama, I nevertheless thought it was actually a pretty effective scene in drawing that out in a movie that otherwise doesn't put anything on the nose.
Well, first off, it's a great joke. I mean, that's how I took it. It's pretty funny as you're watching this guy nod off. There's something fascinating about watching a person in a documentary literally fall asleep.
Right.
We don't see that.
No.
And to realize that this is coming from real toil, which is why this guy can't even stay awake during the show. Maybe it's because he's watching a show that also documents pretty much what is his own life and he just doesn't find it interesting. That's another joke there. But I think this all does tie in too to the idea of work that is captured in this documentary without giving us any information about what they're doing or what their machines do. And the word exhaustion that you use can also be felt in the one sequence where they may be shucking oysters. I'm not sure what they're doing, but there's about three or four guys in a room and they're just doing this repetitive activity, opening something up, moving it down the line. And as many of these scenes do, it lingers there long after we've taken in any new information. And there's something unique about that that's antithetical to what we expect from watching a film. If we're going to watch something for 3 minutes, it better build for us.
Sure.
It better have a climax. It better reach towards something. And some of these scenes do. There's the one that I love where the fish head is flopping back and forth and we're waiting to see if it goes out of that chute into the ocean.
We'll get to that.
There's high drama there. But mostly we get these scenes of the same action happening over and over. And it's emphasizing in this case the repetitiveness, the toil of manual labor.
There's no doubt. What the movie makes very clear is that everything is a machine-like process. All the equipment, the churning of the metal chains, the traps, parts of the boat itself, the knives, the devices they use to cut the fish. You start to see the men really as robotic. There's no doubt about it. They're extensions of the boat. They're extensions of the equipment. They're not really people at all. And I think the movie does dehumanize them in a way that is interesting to consider. I think it gets at what maybe capitalism as a machine does to dehumanize these people and gets at this sense of production in the modern age, even going back to something like what Chaplin's doing in modern times a little bit, maybe with the machines there. And that may be very well the point the filmmakers are trying to make without really directly saying it. I think there's even, this struck me as fascinating too, a parallel in how the people move and act when they aren't working. Think about the long scene we get of the character, I think it's maybe the same fisherman character watching the TV show, taking a shower. Mm-hmm. It's a long scene of him just taking a shower. But the sounds, the camera being as close as it is, and the movements as he washes himself are directly in sync with everything we've seen come before it. The way he moves the soap, the way the water trickles.
It's the water. Yeah.
It's the water. It becomes yet another kind of robotic movement, and he's not even working there. That's supposed to be his free time, his personal time. Another thing that struck me, Josh, and I had just seen this before we taped our review of Stories We Tell, the Sarah Pauly weird experimental documentary. We saw this movie before that. And I think there's an interesting comparison between the two movies, actually, because you've got in Leviathan a film that offers no context to what's going on. There's no sense of self-awareness from the characters that they're involved in the making of a documentary. There's no acknowledged sort of quest for truth. It's just capturing behavior and action. And then you watch Stories We Tell. You've got a film that is really no action at all. It's just context and self-awareness.
Except for the action they make up.
Except for
by recreating scenes from their past.
Otherwise, even that is just about them trying to contextualize their past. So I saw Leviathan in a way as almost a response to Michael Pauly, Sarah Pauly's father, his assertion at the end of Stories We Tell, where he tells her that he thinks it would have been more truthful to just play interviews as they are, but not edit them. And this is a conversation that comes up with documentaries all the time and ethics and truth and subjectivity versus objectivity. But in this movie, we get long takes that are seemingly randomly chosen, and there's no clear hand of a director. But I think you have to ask that question, is it ultimately any more truthful? I'd say not necessarily. I think it's more focused, but it's really just one perspective. And getting one perspective may have its own element of truth, but it doesn't necessarily make it more truthful.
And when they decide to leave these scenes, there's almost more weight on that decision here. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a choice. And because we've been there so long, choosing when to move on, that's huge here.
Yeah, and I do want to mention the scene that you focused on because you love that fish head scene, and you talk about
I
the
do.
Suspense of watching those heads and watching that one in particular, and is it going to get washed out to sea? Here's my thing about that, is as I watched it, sure, you're staring at it for 10 minutes or whatever, so you feel like, what else can you do but sort of play a game with yourself almost of, is it going to go? But for me, my problem, Josh, was there's truly nothing at stake. Nothing changes in anybody's world. The fishes or ours or the fishermen, if that head eventually does wash out to sea or not.
It changes in the seagulls' world.
Well,
all those seagulls out there, Adam, they're waiting for that fish head to go.
That's
no,
a good point.
I'm not really putting all that much importance on
I
it.
Know.
But what was interesting to me about that process is how it did force me to create that mini drama. I did that because I have such this inborn need from watching so many years of films and mainly traditional films to somehow find a story. What's my story going to be here? And so it could very well be that there's no import to that scene at all. But just having been forced to go through that process, I thought was pretty fascinating.
Well, I think for me, the ultimate issue is I found the exercise itself, the fun of using the technology in ways it hasn't been used before to kind of be the ultimate point of the film. And you get to be in the water with those nets, in the holding tank with the fish. It's going to show you what it's like to be caught like a fish and slosh around in the water and hear it.
That's a terrifying scene.
And feel it. You're right. It is terrifying. And it's cool. But that's ultimately, as much as I have to say about the movie, and we could talk for another 10 or 15 minutes about this film, I think I still felt like ultimately that was what I was supposed to take away from it, was the cool factor of the cameras being used in this way. And so it didn't resonate with me the way it clearly did with you. But again, a movie that is out now on DVD, September 24th, that is worth seeing. If only so, you can have another movie at the end of the year when Josh puts it in his top 10. You can rail against him and write in emails saying, Josh, you're nuts.
There's a lot of people in love with this
movie.
No,
you're right. There's
Adam.
A ton of people, a ton of really smart critics who love this film. So I really am in the minority with my more mixed reaction to Leviathan. A couple others we just do want to mention very quickly. These are films that have come up in passing on the show, but are out now on DVD as of September 17th. Simon Killer. This is the film from Antonio Campos. It's the follow-up to his movie After School. Definitely worth seeing. One I mentioned in our top five films of the year so far show, Josh, that I needed to wrestle with again. Room 237, as we talk about Stanley Kubrick, the documentary about all the different meanings, possible interpretations of Kubrick's film The Shining. That's out on the 24th. And Something in the Air or Après Mai. This is the Olivier Assayas coming-of-age film out on September 24th that was in my top five of the year. I can't remember where I had it, maybe number three or four, but it's definitely there among my favorite films of the year. So you can see that now if you haven't had a chance. Maybe it didn't come to a theater near you. It got a very small release. We did touch on a lot of different subjects here on the show. If you have any comments about anything we've discussed or just about the show in general, you can email us anytime, feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Battle of the Year, about dance dream teams in international competition. Think of a movie like Step Up. And Prisoners, this is a film starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Hugh Jackman. Jackman is the father of a daughter, and their neighbor's daughter as well is involved. They get kidnapped and they will do anything to try to get them back. Josh, I've just seen the preview for this movie.
You're out.
I got 15 seconds into it when the kids were heading out the door and said, Mommy and Daddy, we're going to go next door and play. And I knew what was going to happen. And I said, I will never watch this film. I can't. It's my worst nightmare as a parent. I just have to say that. This is, for me, not a one-timer, a movie I watch once and never revisit. This is a zero-timer.
This is a you're walking out of the trailer.
Yeah, I don't think, no matter how many good reviews it gets, and the fact is, it got really good responses in Toronto. Doesn't matter who loves this film. I don't think I can watch it.
All right, fair enough.
So there's my glowing recommendation for Prisoners out this weekend. Also out, Rush, the Ron Howard directed film about the 70s era Formula One driver and his rival. Chris Hemsworth stars in that, as well as Daniel Brühl, who had the great role as the German sniper in Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. Out in limited release this weekend, a handful of films that sound interesting. We're just going to focus on one of them, though. Thanks for sharing. This is the romantic comedy about three friends who meet at sex addiction therapy. It stars Tim Robbins, Mark Ruffalo, and Gwyneth Paltrow. Film.com's David Ehrlich, a critic I like a lot, calls it shame, actually.
Very nice.
Clever. Very clever, David. But he did like the movie that is out now, like I said, here in Chicago and in select theaters. Next week here on the show, we're going to talk about a smaller independent film that's been getting some good buzz, Short Term 12, starring Brie Larson. And we are going to share our top five films of 1993. We're also going to get to the second movie in our Korean auteurs marathon, Woman on the Beach. So back to our normal format and another jam-packed show.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music is from Jason Isbell, comes from his 2013 release, Southeastern. More information is available at jasonisbell.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. This issue I have with you is completely in the spirit of talking about Kubrick, not an attack, not looking for a fight. Okay? I'm not being highly critical of you. I just want that noted, okay? I do want to say
that's a wonderful way to start a conversation.
See, I said maybe that backfired. Now you're gonna be in defensive mode.
No. That didn't put me on the defensive at all.
I try to do the right thing and look, it just blows up in my face. I'm like Ryan O'Neill at the end of Barry Lyndon.